And really, the main concern at this point is where the storm is headed.
Yeah. But which storm are you talking about? Take your pick.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
You know what I
mean? I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, and China Lake, California. Also in California on KFOI up in Red Bluff and Redding, and in Round Mountain on KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you on the internet. So the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have got a whole lot of news to try and get to today. Wish us luck, because it has just been breaking constantly all day long. If we're lucky, I had been hoping originally to go to some of your phone calls today at 818-985-5735, as we've been trying to stay in close touch with listeners in these remarkable days leading up to another remarkable election in these United States. But I don't know if we're going to get there today. In any event, you can line up if you'd like, 818-985-KPFK, no promises. Either way, it will be a while before we get to those calls, if at all, today. As I say, news keeps piling in, including, or maybe even starting with, another hurricane slamming ashore in Florida and one of the worst days on Wall Street in a very long time. And as I want to try and follow up on some election-related stuff that we have been covering, particularly today out of Venezuela, as it may offer some lessons for our own upcoming elections, now just about 90 days away, with early voting starting in some places in just over a month. Even as we don't know who all but official Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris will be naming as her vice presidential pick. That said, an announcement there is said to be coming at any time over the next 12 hours or so. And who knows, it could even come during this broadcast. If we learn anything on that front, Desi Doyen, you'll keep an eye on things and let me know, right?
I will do my best. Okay.
And speaking of elections here in the U.S., I just want to note that voters in the great battleground states of Michigan, as well as Kansas, my old home state of Missouri, and Washington State are all participating in congressional and gubernatorial primaries on Tuesday this week, if they have not already done so via mail-in and or early voting. So hopefully our listeners in those states, if they haven't voted already, I hope you will get out to the polls on Tuesday, given that we are hearing more and more of late about challenges and people purged from the voting rolls in various places. So now is a great time to make sure that you are registered as you think you are registered, in those states, keep checking, no matter what state you're in, to be frank, to make sure you are registered as you think you are, rather than waiting for a surprise to come on November 5th this year. Obviously, I can't underscore that message enough, but I will try. One result from last Thursday's election in Tennessee, where, yes, they hold primary elections on Thursday because apparently they really hope people don't show up to vote. A result that we were not able to get to last week. Far-right U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn, a top Republican ally of former President Donald Trump, will square off this fall in Tennessee against Democratic State Rep Gloria Johnson, according to results reported after Thursday's primary in Tennessee. If you recognize Gloria Johnson's name, it's likely because she was one of the three progressives who briefly shot to national fame when her Republican colleagues in the state legislature tried but failed to kick her out, to kick out her and two of her fellow state reps, to throw them out of office over a protest in favor of gun safety on the chamber floor following a shooting in Nashville that killed three children and three adults at an elementary school in Nashville. Johnson joined with state reps Justin Pearson and Justin Jones in that protest, becoming part of what was dubbed the Tennessee Three. As you'll recall, they faced expulsion hearings for violating House rules, in theory. Pearson and Jones, the two black male members, were expelled, while Johnson, who is white, well, she was spared expulsion by one vote. Shortly after the expulsion vote, Johnson quickly noted that she avoided expulsion, likely because she was white. Republicans denied race was a factor, of course, when they threw out the two black members of the House.
Of course they did.
The scene was broadcast worldwide at the time, and the three made guest appearances on TV and at Democratic events nationally since then. Both Pearson and Jones were eventually reinstated by their constituents to their same posts in the state house shortly after their expulsions. And now the 62-year-old Gloria Johnson has parlayed her courageous protest into the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate this year to run against the 71-year-old far-right Blackburn this November. After her win on Thursday, Johnson said in a fundraising pitch that, quote, "The real fight begins now." She said, "Imagine a better future for Tennessee. Extremism, we'll reject it. Reproductive rights, we'll defend them. Our democracy, we'll fight for it. Better opportunities for working families, you bet we'll make that happen," Johnson wrote. That said, it's likely to be an uphill battle for Johnson against Blackburn in the volunteer state. Tennessee has now only elected Republican statewide candidates for nearly two decades. But in this election year, well, anything could happen at this point, especially if everyone gets out to vote and is allowed to do so, and if their votes are counted, and if those votes are certified as cast. Yeah, I know, that's a lot of ifs, but that's what democracy is up against this year, at least if we are all willing to fight for it. Happily, I've yet to come across any substantive problems for voters at the polls or with tabulation in Tennessee, nor so far in Michigan, Kansas, Missouri, or Washington State. But as always, we're keeping our eyes out for such concerns. Some disturbing election and tabulation-related stuff in a little bit later this hour. But all of this is happening as we are facing storms of varying degrees in both Florida and on Wall Street. Let's start with Florida today. Hurricane Debby reached the Big Bend coast of Florida early on Monday, bringing with it the likelihood of potentially catastrophic flooding and life-threatening storm surge as it slows way down while passing over the northern part of the state of Florida. Forecasters warn that in the coming days, record-setting rain could pummel coastal Georgia and South Carolina, as well as the storm, which landed in Florida as Category 1, heads east. Desi Doyen, I think folks should not be distracted by the fact that Hurricane Debby was only a Category 1 when it made landfall, as we are too often, I think, now looking at the wind speed of these hurricanes versus the damage they are now bringing with record rainfall.
Yes, that is a message that the National Weather Service and meteorologists all over the country have been trying to bring to Americans to say, look, yes, the category tells you the wind speed, but it does not tell you the storm surge. And it's really important to remember that the biggest killer in these storms is flooding. Storm surge and inland floods are the most dangerous parts of hurricanes. 88% of U.S. deaths from tropical storms like Debbie come from the water, not from the wind. So right now, the risks are actually escalating for
the
those
storm
states.
Surge and the rain, should mention. This is
right.
a huge amount of rain.
Exactly. The rain causes that inland flooding, that compound flooding, where residents get hit from all sides, from the coastal storm surge and from inland rivers that are trying to drain out to the ocean. There is nowhere for the water to go. It can take weeks for that water to drain away. So that is the biggest risk right now for everybody in the path of the tropical storm Debbie. So in Florida, as we go to air, at least four confirmed deaths so far from car accidents and falling trees. Debbie made landfall 20 miles south of where Hurricane Idalia hit last year. Now, this is an area, this is, you know, like around Mexico Beach, that kind of Florida Big Bend area. It's a working class retirement community that has been utterly and completely destroyed. And
Twice in less than a year.
Yeah, it's one of the poorest parts of the state, and they really cannot afford another hit. But yet, here we are.
Yep.
Florida storm surge so far, some of it has reached 7 to 10 feet high. Luckily, the storm did not hit at high tide, but high tide is coming in. That can be an issue. The National Weather Service says that rain totals in Florida have reached 19 inches so far.
Really?
Yes.
19 inches since coming ashore just a few hours ago.
Yes,
basically.
So basically that's a lot for a single storm to have brought. And
Yikes.
Yeah, you made the point that Debbie is really slow moving, and that is super dangerous because it gives more time for the storm to dump more rain. It is moving at just 7 miles per hour, which is basically, you know, a speed walking. It's walking to Georgia and across South Carolina. So it could tie or break state rainfall records in Georgia and South Carolina. For a single storm, they're expecting potentially, you know, 10 to 20 inches, maybe as much as 30 or more inches are possible here. So here is the mayor of Savannah, Georgia, Van Johnson. He did not mince words in an interview Monday morning with CBS.
30 inches of rain means what for certain communities here?
It means obliteration for a lot of our city. It is forecast to be a historic event for Savannah.
The number of inches that you think could fall, according to the forecast, what are you looking at?
I've heard 10, 20, I've heard 30 in some cases. Obviously, it's easier to predict as it moves closer. We've heard words like unprecedented, historic, and those are the types of words that concern me. Even they seem amazed at the amount of water that is coming because of this storm. We can handle storm surges. We've worked well with wind gusts, but the issue of water and flooding in a low-lying community, it just creates all kinds of problems that's hard to tabletop to practice for.
What goes through your heart, through your mind?
Pray. Pray.
So that gives you an idea of the dire situation that these areas may be facing as Debbie slow walks across.
And in the Carolinas, I've seen a lot of people specifically paying attention to the Carolinas. North and South Carolina have dealt with three catastrophic floods from tropical storms in the past 9 years, all causing more than $1 billion in damage.
Yes.
In 2015, flooding rains fed by moisture as Hurricane Joaquin passed well offshore, but that nonetheless caused massive flooding that nearly knocked Colombia's water system offline. And in 2016, flooding from Hurricane Matthew caused 24 deaths in the two states, North and South Carolina, and rivers set record flood levels, although that would be broken in 2018 when Hurricane Florence set rainfall records in both Carolinas, flooding many of the same places, and that was responsible for 42 deaths in North Carolina and 9 in South Carolina.
Yeah, so it gives you an idea from what, you know, everyone has been going through in the Southeast with these catastrophic rainfall events and flood events. This is just more than infrastructure can handle. That's why the mayor of Savannah was saying, you know, we can try to prepare for this, but you can only prepare for so much when it just overwhelms every system you have. Flood control, your water treatment plants, your roads, efforts to rescue people from areas that have been cut off.
Can the number of storms that we are seeing in you know, a compressed number of years, along with the amount of damage, all, you know, more than $1 billion storms, huge rainfall amounts, can we tie all of that to climate change?
Oh, of course we can. Because remember, climate change is the background setup that we have for everything now. So we have, first of all, the unusually warm waters of the Atlantic, which are providing fuel to sustain hurricanes. So normally we wouldn't have a second named hurricane until August 24. So the Atlantic is running way ahead of its previous average schedule for named hurricanes. Also, we get more rain. Human-caused climate change makes tropical storms and hurricanes deliver more rainfall than they used to in the past because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. We also have, on top of that, the flooding, rising sea levels. That increases the baseline of the storm surge that hits these areas. And, of course, you know, we also have additional coastal development that has happened in recent decades, so it's putting even more people into harm's way. And then there's another factor of storms that are stalling and slowing down. So some studies have shown that storms are now moving more slowly after landfall than in previous decades, and now they're all stalling more frequently than they have in previous decades. And that there's a considerable body of studies that show that that is related directly to global warming affecting the jet stream.
Thank you very much. I know we'll be covering this throughout the week on our Green News Report and on further broadcasts. Thank you very much. Desi on Debbie. There was also a bit of a storm on Wall Street on Monday as investors decided to freak out a little bit following a worse-than-expected jobs report late last week. After months of such reports exceeding expectations, now they've decided that the one less-than-stellar jobs report is a reason to believe, oh, the U.S. could be on the verge of a recession. Though such fears have come and gone over the past several years, while we climbed out of the pandemic recession, thanks to smart fiscal policies by the Biden and the Biden-Harris administration, the economy is actually very strong, so it's unclear what Wall Street is all panicked about. But investors are panicking again as months of hoping for an economic slowdown would actually encourage the Fed to lower interest rates. Well, now they've got their report of an economic slowdown. And now the Fed is believed likely to be lowering interest rates in September, if not before. But of course, that, which is what they wanted things to slow down so we could lower the interest rates. Well, now that seems to be happening and freaking them out. It didn't help that investors in Japan freaked out about it as well on Monday prior to U.S. markets opening, with the Nikkei plunging about a terrifying 12 percentage points on Monday, seeing its worst day since Black Monday in 1987. Wall Street did not do that badly, although the key indexes were all down anywhere from 2 to 3%. But these are certainly volatile times. Obviously. And speaking of volatile times, as TPM's David Kurtz smartly summarizes today, after its ponderous sojourn in the U.S. Supreme Court, the January 6th case, the federal case against Donald Trump, was officially returned on Friday to U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan in Washington, D.C., and she immediately picked it back up and started moving it forward. Among her initial actions, notably undertaken over the weekend, so she ain't wasting any time here, Judge Chutkan set a Friday, August 9 deadline for the parties to submit a proposed scheduling order for pretrial proceedings. She's ready to go. To set a status conference for next Friday, August 16. She denied a pending Trump motion to dismiss the case on statutory grounds, but gave him the chance to re-up that if once the immunity questions in the case are resolved. And she denied a pending Trump motion to dismiss the case on the grounds of selective and vindictive prosecution, as his attorneys had argued that the Republicans' 2024 presidential nominee was somehow improperly targeted for prosecution in this case, the one filed by special counsel Jack Smith in D.C. related to Trump's many failed attempts to steal the 2020 election. The judge found the defense argument to be speculative and, quote, proffered no meaningful evidence in support. And just like that, Trump's federal January 6th related case is now back up and running again with Chutkin's rulings and orders over the weekend. But, advises David Kurtz, don't hold your breath that this is going to go to trial before the election. Time is too short for that to happen at this point, he says. The elephant in the room is the Supreme Court's expansive and, I would add, ridiculous ruling in this very case on presidential immunity and how much of that will necessarily, and I would add corruptly, narrow the indictment against Trump on currently four felony counts, what kind of evidentiary hearing Chutkin needs to address this newly discovered idea by the corrupted high court of presidential immunity, and, of course, these still unknown ways in which the unprecedented ruling will affect this and, and other Trump prosecutions. Hanging over all of that will likely be at least one more trip to the Supreme Court to give it a chance, to give the Supreme Court yet another chance to weigh in on whether Chutkin properly jumped through all the hoops that the MAGA court has put in her way. So even if it all moves forward quickly, as Chutkin has been doing since she was first put in charge of this case, but certainly since it's been handed back to her, there is simply no way for all of this to happen before Election Day. As Kurtz reports. In other news related to the presidential election over the weekend, Donald Trump reneged on his commitment to a second presidential debate rather than face the new Democratic nominee Kamala Harris. He has previously agreed to the debate on ABC in September, one that had been scheduled to take place like the previous one with Joe Biden without a studio audience. Instead, Trump now proposed a debate hosted by Fox News and in front of a great big arena audience, to which Harris responded, quote, "It's interesting how any time, any place becomes one specific time, one specific safe space."
That's pretty good.
It's a safe space for Donald Trump in front of his peeps, in front of Fox News. Trumpers have been claiming, of course, that he had agreed to a debate with Joe Biden, not with Kamala Harris, so everything is off. But in fact, the agreement struck with ABC News actually did not mention Joe Biden's name. Instead, it detailed how any candidate that met the specific conditions agreed to, the polling conditions and so forth, would be invited to the debate. So, yeah. Kamala Harris is now invited. Joe Biden was invited before. Now Kamala Harris is invited, as is Trump, who appears to be chickening out, or at least backing out of what he had previously agreed to. Oh, that is so Trump. All of that egregiously misreported by the New York Times over the weekend, which used the headline on Saturday, quote, "Trump agrees to a Fox News debate with Harris on September 4th. Citing a post by Trump himself on his social media site claiming the debate, quote, will take place in Pennsylvania. Well, Trump may have agreed with Fox News, I guess, about this, but the Harris campaign had nothing to do with it and says that they plan to stick to the original agreement that Trump now appears to be trying to back out of. And by the way, after a whole bunch of blowback to the New York Times and their egregiously misleading headlines, the paper changed it twice thereafter to make it more, I guess, factual. So first, it was Trump agrees to a Fox News debate with Harris on September 4, as if Harris was hoping to, you know, get him to agree to that. And then they changed it to, quote, Trump proposes a Fox News debate with Harris on September 4. Well, that's a little closer. And then they finally changed it to an actually informative and accurate headline reading, quote, Trump backs out of ABC debate and proposes one with Harris on Fox.
Well, you know, third time's the charm. They're just, you know, the one of the leading media outlets in the United States getting it
in
wrong,
the world.
Right? I know.
Yeah. You okay?
Getting it wrong there.
You okay, New York Times? Because, you know, we really need the New York Times to do better right around now. Thanks in advance. And in some more Trump accountability today, arguably some brighter news. Breaking late this afternoon, actually, we've got a few of these now breaking. The corrupt, packed, stolen activist U.S. Supreme Court appears to have done the right thing on Monday for a change. I'm sure it was an accident. As they declined to halt Donald Trump's upcoming sentencing for his 34 felony convictions in New York State on criminal charges involving hush money paid to a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 presidential election. So that ruling from the Supreme Court would seem to indicate that barring any other legal interventions and or surprises, and there still could be both of those, the former president and current Republican nominee for the 2024 election will be sentenced in criminal court in New York State for those 34 felony convictions on September 18. That's a little less than 2 months before Election Day. He was originally supposed to have been sentenced on July 11, but that date got pushed back due to a motion by Team Trump hoping to toss the case entirely based on that ridiculous Supreme Court presidential immunity ruling. The judge in the New York case, Justice Juan Merchan, is now scheduled to rule on that matter and whether this case should be thrown out entirely coming up in early September. If he allows the case, however, to move forward, then yes, Donald Trump could be sentenced potentially to years in prison by mid-September. And one more, yes, related-ish story before we get to our break. Some more, this is bad news for Donald Trump. This was announced late Monday afternoon, just before airtime. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, her office announced that Jenna Ellis, the former Trump attorney, remember her? And she's also one of the 18 co-defendants in the Arizona fake electors case stemming from the 2020 election. She, Jenna Ellis, is now cooperating with the prosecution. She signed the cooperation agreement on Monday morning, reportedly, according to the announcement, which said that prosecutors are now dropping the charges against her entirely in return for her cooperation. So whatever it is that she has to offer to prosecutors in Arizona, it must be substantial if they are willing to not just, you know, let her plead down to one misdemeanor, but they are dropping the charges against her in full.
Yeah, that's pretty big. I mean, at least
as far, she must have something.
She's got to have something that she can give in order to get that sort of sweetheart plea deal there. That's kind of a big deal. We'll see.
The Attorney General Mays, a Democrat, said in her statement, "This agreement represents a significant step forward in our case. I'm grateful to Ms. Ellis for her cooperation with our investigation and prosecution." Ellis had previously pleaded not guilty to fraud, forgery, and conspiracy charges in the Arizona case. Those will all go away. Mays said about Ellis that her insights are invaluable and will greatly aid the state in proving its case in court. She said, "As I stated when the initial charges were announced, I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It's far too important. Today's announcement is a win for the rule of law." Last year, Ellis was charged in Georgia as well after she appeared with Rudy Giuliani at a December 2020 hearing hosted by state lawmakers at the Georgia Capitol, during which false allegations of election fraud were made by them both. She has pleaded guilty. She pleaded guilty back in October in Georgia to one felony count of aiding and abetting false statements and writings. While not a fake elector in Arizona, prosecutors say Ellis made false claims of widespread election fraud in the state and six others encouraged the Arizona legislature to change the outcome of the election, and encouraged then Vice President Mike Pence to accept Arizona's fake electors vote. Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis today will be able to speak about that quite a bit to the prosecutors. All of those folks, including Giuliani, could face years in prison unless they're smart enough to cooperate with prosecutors and get a deal like Ellis apparently now has. All right, let's take a quick break. We will come back with some election integrity related news, if you can imagine such a thing, after a quick break today. And like I say, maybe some of your calls. I really don't know if we're going to get there, but I will try it. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. If you're in our live listening area in Southern California or listening anywhere via kpfk.org. Take a quick break here and we'll be back. I'm Brad Friedman and you are listening to the world famous, always accurate Bradcast.
Five major corporations now own over 80% of all media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Your support helps us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations across the country. You can make a real difference by supporting independent media. This country ain't gonna save itself, but we can all do it together. Join us at Bradblog.com/donate. That's Bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from Bradblog.com.
Picture of you.
Okay. There we go. Welcome back. Let's see. Where are we here? The storms continue today. And I want to start nonetheless with what happened back in June that we've only just now learned about regarding an election, a primary election. Late last week, Virginia State Senator John McGuire, a former Navy SEAL who was endorsed by former President Donald Trump, late last week, on Thursday, it became official. He defeated far-right Republican Congressman Bob Good in a recount of the June 18 Republican primary results in Virginia's 5th Congressional District, a race that was very close at the time, and we were covering it for a few days on this program. McGuire narrowly defeated Good. So it was sort of a far-right against far-right primary here. McGuire narrowly defeated Good, who is one of the farthest-right members of Congress, as the chair of the hard-right House Freedom Caucus, after Good was opposed by Trump because Good had the temerity to endorse Ron DeSantis early on in the primary process before later switching his endorsement over to Trump. But I guess not soon enough. And Good was also opposed by former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, because Good was one of eight Republicans who voted against the then Speaker, leading to his ouster. Nobody, it seems, liked Bob Good, no matter how radical right he actually was and how right-wing his primary opponent, John McGuire, also is. Well, I shouldn't say nobody liked him, because about half of the people in the half of the Republican voters in the district voted for him, but it was really close. Election officials previously had certified McGuire as the narrow winner by just 374 votes out of nearly 63,000 cast. But with the margin of victory at just 0.6 percentage point, in McGuire's favor, Good was entitled to a recount. So Virginia law allows a recount, allows a candidate to ask for a recount in races with margins that are smaller than 1 percentage point, but it will only pay for them if they are 0.5 percentage point or less. And so at 0.6 of a percent, just above 0.5 percent, Good's going to have to foot the bill for that recount, which occurred last Thursday. It's estimated to cost him about $100,000. McGuire's margin of victory narrowed after the recount by 4 votes to just 370 votes. After that recount on Thursday, which was carried out largely on the same computer tabulators that tallied the hand-marked paper ballots in Virginia the first time. So the lack of change in the original results, really not that much of a surprise since they were all counted on the same machines, but the machines were set in this recount to kick out any ballots that the machine saw as having either no vote at all in this particular race or having too many votes in this particular race, so that those ballots could then subsequently be manually examined by, you know, human beings, the recounters and representatives of both campaigns. A state judge subsequently declared McGuire to be the official winner of the election. Now, Bob Good is an election denier himself, at least regarding Donald Trump's 2020 loss, which he voted against certifying in Congress. He had previously echoed a line that has often been used by Donald Trump and other election denialists, falsely claiming that the drop boxes, the absentee mail-in ballot drop boxes across the district, were somehow not secured and allowed for massive fraud. There is no evidence of that. And I guess to his credit, he seems to have abandoned that claim now that all the votes have been tallied for a second time. In a statebook on Facebook, Good thanked those who voted for him and supported his reelection campaign, saying that though he was, quote, disappointed in the ultimate outcome, he was honored to have served as the congressional representative for Virginia's 5th district over the past 3.5 years.
Wait, you mean he's accepting the loss and moving on? And he's a Republican?
It appears to be the case.
Is he okay?
I don't know. He's good. He's Bob Good. That's how it's supposed to happen, how a contested election is supposed to end. You're supposed to challenge in court or ask for a recount, hopefully a hand count as opposed to a machine count. But then when that's all settled, you congratulate your opponent, you thank your voters, and you move on. With a public account of the ballots, at least a public-ish recount, if sought by one of the candidates and a concession when public oversight has accurately determined who won or lost the election, then we all move on. That's what happened here, thanks to public oversight of hand-marked paper ballots in Virginia. Now, whether Donald Trump will or would be quite as gracious if he ends up losing again this November, well, that remains to be seen. Although maybe we could guess. But there may be a thing or two that we can learn about what is happening right now down in Venezuela when it comes to public oversight of elections and the need for public oversight of elections. We've been covering over the past week or so since Venezuela held its presidential election, with a broad array of opposition parties coalescing together to challenge the authoritarian leader of its one-party government. That would be President Nicolas Maduro. The nation's National Election Council, after that election, a council, by the way, stacked with loyalists to Maduro, on election night, they declared Maduro to be the winner of that election over the opposition leader, Edmundo González. But they and Maduro have since refused to release the actual results from voting machines in some 30,000 precincts across the country so that the public can know if Maduro actually won or if the opposition, which claims that it won by a landslide, if they actually won the election. They're refusing to allow anything even close to what Bob Good was able to ask for in his Virginia race in the 5th congressional district, a chance for everyone to see how the votes came out. Maduro is still refusing to release precinct-based results Never mind, you know, ballots so that we can actually count them again. He won't even release the numbers from each of the precincts around the country. That has led to protests and violence once again in the streets of Venezuela. Without public oversight of the full election results, we have been left to guess at this point who won and who lost. With the U.S., a longtime adversary of Maduro, claiming that the opposition won the election. But again, do we know? We don't know. And the leaders of Colombia and Brazil, who are both allies of Maduro, they have also joined the demand that the full results be publicly released. I know we had some callers and some emailers. You can write me, by the way, I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You can tweet me, I'm TheBradBlog on Twitter. You can give us a call at 818-985-KPFK if I have time to get to it, because I know that there are a lot of people who say, well, I don't trust the U.S. on this at all. Well, good. You shouldn't trust the U.S. You should be skeptical. You should also be skeptical of the leaders of Colombia and Brazil, who are allies of Maduro, and even they say they don't know what happened in the election. The results from the precincts should be released. And without that data, we're just left to work with the smaller subset of data that is available. And according to an analysis by the opposition parties and subsequently confirmed, at least to some extent, by the New York Times and other media outlets in recent days, it does appear, at least, that Maduro lost. And lost by a landslide. At least if these analyses are correct. Of course, we could know if they were correct if Maduro released the results, but so far, he has refused. So again, we're left to guess because he won't release the actual precinct-based data on what his National Election Council describes as a comfortable margin of victory for Maduro, entitling him to another 6 years in office. Why won't they release it? And yet, the partial election results that were provided to the New York Times by a group of researchers associated with Venezuela's main opposition alliance, they supply new evidence that calls the official results into question. That, according to the Times last week, the researchers, their figures suggest that the opposition candidate, Gonzalez, actually beat Maduro, not just by a little, but by more than 30 percentage points. That after Maduro's election council claimed that Maduro had won by about 7 points, 51-44% over Gonzalez. But the researchers, whose work was separately confirmed, as I said, by the New York Times, based on this smaller subset of polling results that they were able to obtain, at least the opposition groups were able to obtain, they estimate that support for Gonzalez was more than twice that for Maduro. So how did they come to that conclusion? Well, an independent third-party group before the election had randomly selected some 1,500 precincts that they said were representative of the nation, both districts that were for Maduro and against them, that they were, you know, roughly reflective of the country. And they had planned to get these copies of these 1,500 precincts, copies of the results that are printed out by the nation's touchscreen voting machines at the end of the night at each polling place. And the nation's elections, mind you, are highly controlled by the ruling Socialist Party, but people are apparently still allowed to get printouts from precincts on election night. Ironically, by the way, it's something that I often call for in this country, for voters to show up at the precinct on election night and take photos of the so-called poll tapes, the results that are printed out by the voting machines
before
they
move anywhere else. That's why you get that transparency on election night at the precinct level.
And this group, this called Alta Vista, they had planned to, in fact, obtain and examine these results from some 1,500 precincts. Now, the Times couldn't independently verify the underlying results on all of this, whether these poll tapes were really from those specific precincts or not. But since, you know, we're all forced to work with what we got here, well, the Times examined the receipts from about 1,000 voting machines that were ultimately obtained by AltaVista. That's about 3% of the country's total, and compared them to the extrapolated them out and compared them to the totals from those same precincts in the nation's three previous elections. So the vote totals in these precincts show Gonzalez, the opposition candidate, would be projected to have defeated Maduro by a margin of 66% to 31%. Even in the ruling party's strongholds in previous elections, the data show that voters shifted away from Maduro. So, to confirm those numbers, what the Times did was they looked back at the results from those same 1,000 precincts for which they have the poll tapes now from this year's election. They took those, they looked, as I understand it, at the same 1,000 precincts in previous elections, and they did the same extrapolation to the entire country. And when they extrapolated and compared to the official results in those previous elections, they were almost exactly within 1 or 2 points of the officially reported results. The official results that were announced by the National Election Council in those years. So, for example, in 2015, the data from those same 1,000 precincts show that the winner would have received 38% of the vote that year. In fact, that the official national results that year in 2015 showed that the winner had received 39%. So this extrapolation back in 2015 using these exact same precincts was just 1% off of what the national results actually were. In 2018, the winner, again Maduro, would have received 66% of the vote that year according to the same extrapolation formula from those same 1,000 precincts. In fact, the national result that year was 67% for the winner. Again, a less than 1 percentage point difference from the official results using the same 1,000 precinct, the results from the same 1,000 precincts they are working with now this year. And one more before we get to this year. In 2021, the extrapolated results from those precincts gave the winner 44% of the vote nationwide. And in fact, yes, the official results were 45% for the winner. So this would seem to be a good method to use. Extrapolating from these 1,000 precincts from which they do have the data, the results data from election night. But this year, in 2024, when they use the data said to have come from those 1,000 precincts, guess what? Well, according to their data, Maduro would have received just 30% of the vote compared to the official results stating that Maduro won the election with 51% of the vote. In other words, that is a miss by 21 points from what the election results should have been. 21 points off. Now, I know, as I said, many are skeptical about the U.S. when it comes to Venezuela. They should be. But if these data are correct, and given it's all that we have to work with because Maduro won't, you know, release all of the precinct data, well, it certainly looks like Maduro did lose in a landslide to the opposition leader by about 20 points or more. And since the Times analysis, both the AP and Washington Post have found similar results from the data that they have found to be available, data which shows that Gonzalez won by an even larger share in their analysis. So, yeah, it's all imperfect. And there is every reason to be skeptical of both the opposition's claims, as well as the U.S. government's claims, as well as media outlets like the Times and the Post and AP. But there's also reason to be skeptical of the Maduro government here, who refuses to release the information. And without real public oversight of the full election results, these extrapolations from limited data, that is all that we have to work with. But those extrapolations also match up pretty close with exit polling said to have been taken that day. But as I'm not a huge fan of taking away too much from exit polling, I will just note that all of these extrapolated numbers based on existing data from different sources seem to match up in general, while the official National Election Council's number in Venezuela decidedly do not come even close. But that is what happens when the public is unable to oversee the full results of an election. And it's something that I hope election officials in this country are taking close notice of as we head toward an election with a whole lot of folks who are predisposed to not trust anything reported by election officials. And in truth, as I've made clear now, for many years, 20 years or so, they shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to merely trust election officials. Elections should be transparent and overseeable by the public. And they are in this country in a lot of places, but not everywhere. So, yes, Donald Trump is going to lie about those results, whatever they may be, unless he's announced as the winner, of course. And Republicans are already putting in plans to steal the election in case Donald Trump is named as the loser by simply refusing to certify results that they don't like. But the more the data is made public and available for oversight by the public, the better chance that we have of an election with results that the bulk of the nation will respect as legitimate. And that includes in places like Georgia, where they are still planning to use touchscreen voting systems across the entire state, which can never be verified as having accurately reflected even a single voter's vote. If you live in Georgia, vote on a hand-marked paper ballot. Do it absentee and drop it off in person. Because the more the data is made public and available for oversight, the better chance we have of having an election with results that at least the bulk of the nation will respect as legitimate, even if Donald Trump lies about them. Public oversight, still the only thing that's going to save us in elections, in our democracy. And they ain't got it right now in Venezuela, at least not full public oversight. But where they do have it, with limited data, it does seem to suggest, at least for now, that Nicolas Maduro lost in a landslide to the opposition's Edmundo Gonzalez, no matter how skeptical you might be about the longtime opposition by U.S., to the leadership of Venezuela.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's really important, this stuff, to understand how actual election laws and procedures work so that you can, you know, at least here in the United States, inoculate yourself against election administration. You know, like the disinformation that Bob Good tried to put out in his Virginia election about how, you know, secure ballot drop boxes are not actually secure, and then he drops it.
And when you let, because people were able to see what happened, they were able to count the ballots for themselves. They were see that there was no evidence for
exactly.
his claims.
Exactly. That's why it's important.
Let me get to some phones here real quick because I know a couple of folks want to ring in on this. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to Bill in Santa Monica. Hey, Bill, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Brad.
Hey.
If you're saying that the Venezuelan election didn't reflect the will of the people, there was the election of two Republican presidents in this century did not reflect the will of the people because they both lost the
popular vote?
Popular vote.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just stay out of it in Venezuela and take care of our own business.
Well, our own business is a system that is an electoral college system. And you or I might not like it, but it is the system until we change that system. Why would we
It was established by slavers. And as being a black man, it's especially offensive to me.
Good. Let's change it. And by the way, in other states where they have elections, let's hold them to the same standards that we should be holding ourselves to in this country. Why should we stay out of it? Why shouldn't we make sure that a vote by the people is actually honored by the leaders? Why should we stay out of that, Bill?
Because it's not honored by it in this country. So why don't we take care of this country before we take care of what's happening in Venezuela? And we also seem to only have a problem when it's a leftist leader that's put into place. We have no problem with the dictators that we supported for a couple of hundred years
on this continent
and in South America.
I have a problem with them.
But you're not really mentioning that much. You seem to have a really deep problem with leftists.
What are you talking
like
about? That's
propaganda.
That's,
you're probably
that's
like a propagandist.
Oh, stop.
49 Bill. States government.
Oh, Bill, stop that.
Oh, Bill what?
Oh, Bill,
no, I'm not
stop stopping that.
Stop.
When
how
I,
do you know?
I have gone to bat for right-wingers, left-wingers.
Why would you
I have
go to
gone
bat
to bat for
right-wingers?
Any...
Why would you go to bat
because
for
even a right-winger deserves to have an election in which his or her voters know whether he or she won or lost. That's how democracy works, Bill.
Well,
and I don't care if
it's... The right wing doesn't do that. They'll cheat, they'll lie, they'll
yes,
steal.
Yes, they will.
And their feet should be held to the fire. It's the Michelle Obama philosophy. They go low, we go high, and every time we get the hell kicked out of us.
So we should be cheating
should be exactly what
right.
they are.
All right, gotcha. Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that call. Bill, in favor of cheating in elections, Bill against democracy, I guess. Gee Louise. Let me go to Larry in San Pedro. Hey, Larry, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Brad.
Hey.
My understanding of how an October surprise would work is rather sketchy. Basically, what would happen would be the certification is challenged. It goes to the high court. The high court then kicks to the House of Representatives. And beyond that is where it gets muddy for me. So can you sort of walk us through and help us understand how this might work?
I would love to
can prevent it, and I'm going to take the answer off here.
Yeah, I would. Larry, I'm sorry. I've got literally less than a minute to explain an incredibly complicated issue. So pardon me for being terse here. In fact, an October surprise could be anything, but I think what you're talking about is actually a January 6th surprise, where in Congress they refused to certify the Electoral College. That's what they tried to do back in 2020. Mike Pence wasn't playing along with that. He wasn't going to go along with the fake electors. But that's what they're hoping to do now. They're hoping to not certify the election in certain states so they can go to Congress and say, hey, we don't know who won it. What are we going to do? In order to throw it to the U.S. House, in which case in the U.S. House, there's a state-by-state vote. So whichever party controls each state will essentially vote for who will become the president. And a straight majority wins. It's sort of the nightmare scenario, but it is the one that Republicans do seem to be working toward. I hope I've made that somewhat clear in the ridiculously short time I had to do so. If not, we got a few months. I bet the issue's going to come up again, and we'll talk about it more then. Thanks, Larry. I got to get out. My thanks to our producer today, of course, Desi Doyen, to our board operator, Wendell Hendy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it for free at bradblog.com. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog, where, yes, we believe in democracy. That's it. Until we meet again, we'll see you there, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.